All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Hey guys, this right here is going to be the material covering the AHA's ACLS respiratory failure, respiratory arrest section of the ACLS manual. Again, I'm not endorsed by the AHA or sponsored by them. I just know that they put out some really good stuff and their courses are very difficult. And this podcast is aiming to help with making some of that material a little bit easier to master. But this right here is the respiratory section. And the biggest takeaway from that is if you're a GCS less than 8, you're going to intubate. If you have a gag reflex with your patient, you're going to be using a nasopharyngeal airway. If you do not have a gag reflex, you can use an OPA, an oral pharyngeal airway, or you can use an LMA. I forget what the LMA stands for, but it's a big ass tube that goes down your throat that does not go into that does not pass the vocal cords. It looks uncomfortable and it makes you want to become a DNR when you see one in place. I can tell you that right now. But regardless, that right there is kind of the big takeaways. If you have a gag reflex, you're going to be using an NPA. If you do not have a gag reflex, you're going to be using an OPA or an LMA. And then if your GCS is less than 8, you're going to be intubating. But yeah, I think that's everything that I have for the respiratory section of ACLS. So again, this is coming from the AHA's or American Heart Association's Advanced Cardiac Life Support Provider Manual. And again, I am not endorsed or sponsored by them.
Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, blood.
He's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bed. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in. The top of the vehicle was caved in.
Hanging out parts of the window. She's been 45 minutes of CPR.
Welcome back to the deep dive. Okay, we've got this really dense stack of ACLS sources here, but today we're applying that 80-20 rule. Right? Focusing specifically on respiratory arrest and, well, mastering the airway.
That's exactly it. We're not just, you know, listing facts. The idea is to pull out that critical 20%, the absolute must-knows, the techniques, the numbers, the things you can't do.
The contraindications.
Right. Because those deliver like 80% of the success in these life-saving moments. And this area, respiratory arrest, it's where acting early really pays off. You can actually stop a full cardiac arrest.
Right. Before it even gets started. And it seems like the big pitfall here, the thing people get wrong, is doing too much. Like the urge to overcorrect when it comes to breathing.
Absolutely. We're diving into why sometimes doing less is actually the life-saving move.
Okay, let's jump in. Core foundations first. Hashtag tag I. Core high-yield foundations. Recognize, intervene, prevent.
So first things first, we absolutely have to nail down the difference because honestly, everything else depends on this initial assessment. What is respiratory arrest?
Okay, yeah, let's break that down because in the middle of a code, it's chaotic.
Right.
And knowing if it's just respiratory arrest or full cardiac arrest changes your first step completely.
Completely. So respiratory arrest is defined by what the patient still has. They're unconscious. Yeah. Their breathing is gone or it's really, really poor. You know, like those agonal gasps.
Those awful gasping breaths. Yeah.
Exactly. But, and this is the key, they have a pulse. You check for that pulse in your first 10 seconds, the BLS check. If it's there, you're dealing with ventilation, not compressions. Ventilation first.
Got it. Pulse present means it's a breathing problem first and foremost. So our immediate action is all about ventilation, and there's a very specific way to do it.
Precisely. The intervention is ventilation. Yeah. And the number one thing, the absolute number you have to burn into your brain is the rate. It's one breath every 6 seconds.
One breath every 6 seconds.
Which works out to 10 breaths a minute. And you cannot rush this. You give those breaths, reassess after 2 minutes. If the pulse is gone, then okay, then you switch to CPR, but not before.
Okay, that leads right into that rule that feels backwards at first. Avoiding too much ventilation. We're all trained, you know, fight hypoxia, get oxygen in. But here, too much air is actually bad. Can you really make that danger clear for us?
Yeah, we really need to get the why behind this. When you ventilate too much, either too fast or too big a breath.
Squeezing the bag too hard?
Right. You massively increase the pressure inside the chest. The intrathoracic pressure. Now think about those big veins, the vena cava, bringing blood back to the heart.
Okay, yeah, the high pressure in the chest must squeeze them right.
You got it. It's like putting a clamp on those return lines. That high pressure crushes venous return. And if blood isn't getting back to the heart, well, the heart can't pump it out. Your cardiac output tanks.
Wow.
And it gets worse. Too much ventilation can also clamp down on the arteries in the brain's cerebral vasoconstriction. So you're reducing blood flow there too. You're fighting the very circulation you're trying to save.
That's a really powerful way to think about it.
Yeah.
You're protecting circulation by not overventilating. Okay, so when we start with that bag mask, giving those slow breaths, 100% oxygen, What's the volume we're aiming for? Like, how much air?
You know, it's less about hitting a specific number on a dial and more about what you see. You just need enough air to get visible chest rise. Just see the chest move slightly.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. Clinically, it works out to around 6 to 7 milliliters per kilogram. But honestly,
cool.
In the moment, just watch the chest, see it move, stop squeezing. That's enough.
Okay, so a really sharp clinician often stops a code way before it becomes a full arrest. They see the decline. How do we spot that slide from respiratory distress into respiratory failure? That tipping point.
Yes, spotting that decline is maybe the most high yield skill of all. So distress is when the patient's fighting, they're compensating, they're breathing fast tachypnea, they're using extra muscles in their neck and chest.
Accessory muscles.
Right. Maybe you hear stridor, they're working hard to breathe. That's distress.
But then failure hits. And sometimes, creepily, the hard work seems to stop, right? Which is actually worse.
That's often the case. The quiet patient can be the one crashing the hardest. In failure, all those backup systems just give out. You might see that fast breathing suddenly slow way down or stop altogether, apnea, their mental state plummets, stupor, maybe coma. They might look blue, cyanotic.
That's the cliff edge.
That's the cliff edge. They're not getting enough oxygen in, hypoxemia, or they're not getting CO2 out, hypercapnia, or both. This needs immediate action, like right now. You are seconds, literally seconds from cardiac arrest.
Okay, so we have to intervene. We need to open the airway on this unconscious patient. What's the go-to quickest technique usually?
The default is the head tilt chin lift. Yeah. Simple, fast. 9 times out of 10, the tongue is blocking the airway and this just lifts it out of the way.
Simple enough. But then there's the big gotcha, the trauma scenario. That changes the game.
It really does. If you have any reason to suspect a neck injury, a C-spine injury, you absolutely must use the jaw thrust maneuver without tilting the head back.
Okay, jaw thrust.
But, and this is crucial, real-world nuance, keeping the spine perfectly, still comes second to getting air in. If you try the jaw thrust and it's not working, you cannot get the chest to rise. You have to try the head tilt chin lift.
Really? Even with suspected trauma?
Yes. Because the absolute priority is patent airway and getting oxygen in. A patient who can't breathe is going to die, regardless of their C-spine. You do the least amount of movement necessary, but you must ventilate. Dead brains don't heal, C-spine injury or not.
That's a critical point about prioritizing life over limb, essentially. Okay, airway's open, we're using the BVM.
Right.
What's the best way to actually hold the mask to get a good seal so we can deliver that slow 1 every 6 seconds breath?
The standard is the CE clamp technique. Works well. You make a C shape with your thumb and index finger over the top of the mask, pushing it down onto the face.
Okay, the C.
And then your other 3 fingers make an E along the jawline, lifting the jaw up into the mask. That combination usually gets you a good seal. But it takes practice, and honestly, it can be tiring. That's why, if you have enough people, a 2-person BVM technique is often much better. One person focuses just on the seal, the other just on squeezing the bag.
Makes sense. And just a quick reminder while we're doing all this breathing management, if you suspect an opiate overdose caused the respiratory arrest, giving naloxone is definitely part of the treatment plan.
Good point. Absolutely consider naloxone if the picture fits. #tag3, high yield adjuncts and critical details, the airway toolkit.
All right, so we've got our BVM technique down, but sometimes that's not enough. or we need something a bit more stable temporarily, that's where the adjuncts come in, the OPA and the MPA. But man, these carry big risks if you use them wrong.
Huge risks. Let's start with the OPA, the oropharyngeal airway, the hard plastic one. Put this in the wrong patient and you can cause a disaster instantly. What's the absolute non-negotiable rule?
No gag reflex, right?
Exactly. The OPA is only for patients who are completely unresponsive and have no protective reflexes. Zero cough, zero gag. If you try to shove that thing in someone who can gag,
they're going to vomit.
They're going to vomit, or worse, get laryngospasm where the airway clamps shut. And just like that, you've turned a breathing problem into an aspiration nightmare.
That's like the classic mistake, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rushing to put an OPA in someone who's just really out of it, but not completely unresponsive.
Oh, yeah. Every experienced provider has probably had that stomach-dropping moment where you start putting it in and the patient gags. Ugh. That's why you have to insert it carefully, either curve pointing up towards the roof of the mouth, then rotate 180 degrees as you go past the tongue.
The rotation technique.
Or use a tongue depressor to hold the tongue down and slide it straight in. But the key is checking that gag reflex first.
Okay, so OPA is for the deeply unresponsive.
Yeah.
What about the MPA? The nasopharyngeal airway, the soft rubbery one that gives us a bit more leeway.
It does. The MPA goes through the nose, sits behind the tongue. It's much softer and generally better tolerated. So you can use an MPA in patients who are conscious or semi-conscious, people who do still have a gag reflex.
Okay, that's useful.
But it has its own really dangerous gotcha. And this one involves trauma again.
Facial trauma, head injury.
Exactly. If your patient has major facial injuries, especially like mid-face fractures or signs of a basilar skull fracture, think raccoon eyes, battle sign behind the ear.
Right, the bruising.
Yeah, if you see that, you have to be incredibly careful with an MPA or maybe avoid it altogether, because there's a small but real risk you could actually push it up through a fractured bone, the cribriform plate, and into the brain cavity.
Oof. Okay, note taken. Be very wary of NPAs with significant head or facial trauma. Now, moving up the ladder, advanced airways, ET tubes, supraglottic devices like LMAs. Once that's in place, let's hammer home that ventilation rate again, because this gets confused all the time.
It really does. The rate does not change just because you have an advanced airway in, whether it's basic BVM or a fancy tube. If the patient has a pulse and it's respiratory arrest, the rate is still one breath every 6 seconds, 10 breaths a minute.
Not the faster rate used during CPR with an advanced airway.
No. That faster asynchronous ventilation only happens when you're doing continuous chest compressions and cardiac arrest. If there's a pulse, it's always 1 in 6. Slow and steady.
Got it. And confirming the tube is in the right place and staying there and working. Gold standard is capnography. Mandatory. Can you quickly explain what that little waveform is actually showing us?
Sure. Capnography, or ET COS, measures the carbon dioxide level at the very end of the patient's exhaled breath. It gives you a real-time graph, tube in the lungs, you get a nice, consistent, boxy waveform.
And if it's in the esophagus?
Flatline, or maybe a tiny blip that disappears fast as the stomach gas clears. But it's more than just placement. It continuously tells you the tube hasn't slipped out, and critically, it shows if your breaths are actually exchanging gas effectively. #tag IV, critical thinking and monitoring priorities.
Let's stick with capnography for a second, because you said it's not just for advanced airways, right? It's a thinking tool, even with just a bag mask. How does that work?
Yeah, this is really useful. Say you're struggling with the BVM, maybe the patient's airway is difficult, or you're not sure you're getting a good seal. If you attach an ETCO sensor to the BVM...
You could do that.
Absolutely. You put it between the bag and the mask. That waveform, or lack of it, tells you immediately if you're actually moving air in and out of the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
Flatline. You've got a problem, bad seal, obstruction. Maybe you're actually bagging too fast and not letting them exhale. It gives you objective feedback beyond just watching the chest.
That really changes things. It's not just guessing based on chest rise anymore.
Okay, circling back to trauma and the C-spine, we said airway first, but also manual stabilization is better than just slapping on a collar. Can you elaborate on why?
Right. So when trauma is suspected, you ideally have someone whose only job is to hold the head still manually in a neutral inline position. Why manual? Because those rigid cervical collars, while they seem secure, can actually get in the way.
How so?
They can make it harder to open the mouth wide enough. Sometimes they limit the neck movement you might need for intubation later. And they can even interfere with getting that perfect BVM seal around the chin and jaw. So manual control is preferred. The collar is an adjunct, not the primary method during active airway management.
Good clarification. Okay, last point in this section. Suctioning. We need to clear the airway sometimes before we can ventilate.
Right.
What's the hard stop, the time limit for each suction attempt?
This is a classic test question and a crucial safety point. Limit every single suction attempt to 10 seconds or less. No longer.
10 seconds. Why so strict?
Because when you're suctioning, you're not just removing secretions, you're sucking out oxygen too. Go longer than 10 seconds, and you can rapidly drop their oxygen levels, cause significant hypoxemia. If you have to suction quickly, then get back to oxygenating, take breaks.
And if you're suctioning through an ET tube or track?
Then you absolutely need sterile technique. Use a sterile catheter each time to avoid pushing bacteria down into the lungs. Hashtag tag V. Quick recall summary and final thought.
Okay, this has been incredibly focused. Really drilling down on those high yield points for respiratory arrest, the things that make the biggest difference in those first critical moments. Let's wrap it up with a super fast 2-minute recall. The absolute must remember facts.
Let's do it. Rapid fire recall.
Respiratory arrest definition. Pulse is present, but breathing is absent or inadequate. Your primary job is ventilation.
Ventilation rate. Non-negotiable 1 breath every 6 seconds. That's 10 breaths per minute. Same rate for BVM or advanced airway if a pulse is present.
Tidal volume. Don't blast them. Just enough for visible chest rise. Avoid overventilating. It kills cardiac output. Remember that venous return.
Trauma airway. Jaw thrust first. If that fails, prioritize the airway even if it means careful head tilt chin lift. And manual C-spine stabilization beats relying solely on a collar during airway management.
OPA rule. The big one. No cough. No gag reflex. Only for completely unresponsive patients. Otherwise, consider an MPA. But watch out for facial head trauma.
Advanced airway confirmation. Waveform capnography is mandatory. It's your best friend for placement and continuous monitoring. Confirms you're in the lungs and ventilating effectively.
And suctioning. Max 10 seconds per attempt. Don't cause hypoxia. Sterile technique for advanced airways. Did we miss anything major?
I think that covers the absolute core essentials. Avoid excess ventilation, know your rates, know your adjunct rules, and use capnography.
Perfect. So let's end with a final thought. We focused on the how-to. What's the bigger picture takeaway here?
Well, if you think about how devastating hypoxia and hypercapnia are, lack of oxygen, buildup of CO2, and how quickly they affect the whole body, it makes you wonder, right? How often in the real world do we maybe see those early signs of respiratory failure?
Like the past breathing, the muscle use.
Exactly. The marked tachypnea, maybe they're using accessory muscles, but quietly, maybe they're just a little confused. How often do we brush that off as, I don't know, anxiety or something else less critical, when really it's the beginning of that slide towards arrest?
That's a sobering thought.
The real mastery isn't just running the code for respiratory arrest. It's recognizing that patient who's about to arrest, seeing the failure before it happens, and intervening correctly with the right ventilation strategy before that pulse disappears. That's the highest yield intervention of all.
Recognizing failure before it becomes arrest. A really powerful final thought. Thank you for taking us through this critical deep dive today.
My pleasure. It's vital stuff.